Broadcast of the Economic Club of Indiana Speaker Series is made possible in part by ProLiance Energy. ProLiance, adding power to energy. Information is at ProLiance.com.
The opinions and commentary expressed in the following presentation do not reflect the views of this station, the Economic Club of Indiana, or the Economic Club's agents or sponsors. Welcome to the Economic Club of Indiana. Today's speaker is economist Gary Becker. He grew up in a Pennsylvania coal mining town, the son of Canadian and European immigrants. He went on to Princeton and Nobel Prize-winning fame.
Maybe the only Nobel Prize-winning economist who could say that he got his start in the field by accidentally enrolling in an economics class as a college freshman. During that class at Princeton University, though, our speaker saw the potential for combining two of his interests, math and doing something useful for society. Following his graduation from Princeton, he did graduate work in economics at the University of Chicago, where he studied under Milton Friedman. And during a conversation at lunch, he said Milton Friedman was by far the best teacher he ever had. And Milton Friedman encouraged him to use economic theory to promote social change. Now, while Professor Becker was influenced by Milton Friedman, he in turn has influenced many others. He has a wide range of interests that include labor economics, education, economics and discrimination, the family, crime, addiction, and immigration. A keen observer of the U.S. and global economy, has probably done more than any other person to expand the domain of economics. Today, a professor of economics and sociology at the University of Chicago, our speaker is a recipient of many awards, including the 1992 Nobel Prize in Economic Sciences, the National Medal of Science, and the Presidential Medal of Freedom. The author of a dozen books, for 19 years until 2004, he was a regular columnist for Business Week. And for the past 7 years, he and his longtime friend, Richard Posner, have written a blog that you may have noticed was profiled in the Education Life section of last Sunday's New York Times. He and Judge Posner have co-authored a book based on that blog, a book titled Uncommon Sense, Economic Insights from Marriage to Terrorism. Draw your own conclusions. Maybe you'll speak about that. Actually, he's going to speak to us about the slow recovery and long-run challenges to the American economy. Would you please join me in welcoming Professor Gary Becker?
Thank you very much, Mr. McClelland. It's a pleasure for me to be here and address this audience. When I got invited, I was glad to accept, and I assumed there'd be maybe 100 people here, so I was a little surprised when I'm told that you usually get such a big turnout, and I look forward to the questions you will address to me. And I was also told that Milton Friedman addressed this group several times, and as it was said, he was my great teacher I had and a close friend and a great speaker. So even though he's been deceased for a number of years and hasn't addressed this audience for a long time, he's definitely a very hard act to follow, even with this great delay. My topic is the financial crisis, its effects, and more importantly, I'm going to concentrate and lead in from that into the long-term problems facing the U.S. I won't be shy about giving you my opinions for what we should be doing, and I would appreciate blunt questions in return. Now, the financial crisis that we've had, and is basically over, although there are residual elements of it still, was the greatest, certainly, financial crisis since the Great Recession of the 30s, and maybe the greatest economic catastrophe since the 30s. So that we'll have to wait and see how it plays out. Unemployment peaked at 10.2% in October of 2009. GDP fell substantially, and it remains around 10% below the long-term trend line of what GDP would have been in the absence of the crisis. The recovery has been much slower than in some previous recessions. For example, if we look at the recession of 81-82, unemployment peaked actually at a higher level at that time than during this crisis, at 10.8%, which is significantly higher than 10.2%. Yet by 1984, unemployment was down, averaging 7.5% for that year. So it declined by 3.3 percentage points over like an 18-month period. In this recession, in the 18 months since the peak, unemployment rate has declined by 1.3 percentage points from 10.2 to 8 point, maybe the latest number is 8.8, so 1.3, 1.4 percentage points, less than half of the decline in the previous recession. National income grew rapidly once we had the recovery in the early recession. It's been growing slowly in the last few years. So I have two questions. One, why the slow recovery? And that leads me into what some of the long-term problems that are facing the U.S. I think the slow recovery was a consequence of two basic forces. One, the financial crisis was a very serious crisis. So in the best of circumstances, with the best of policies, the recovery, I believe, would have been slower than in 81-82. But I don't think it was the best of circumstances. There was a lot of uncertainty created not only by the crisis, which one can understand, but also by public policy or threats about public policy that discouraged investment, discouraged business from hiring in particular. Now, what are some of these uncertainties? Well, tax uncertainty. Will taxes be raised and on whom? This has been pushed aside finally now, and unemployment actually has begun to come down much more rapidly. It was pretty flat for quite a while. I don't think it's exactly an accident that after there was an agreement on not raising taxes, we had a faster decline in unemployment. Medical costs, how that will affect business. Many of you here are in business in one way or another. How would the changes in the medical program, coverage, required coverage and like, affect business, especially small business? A lot of uncertainty about that. And medical costs are becoming a more important part of hiring labor, particularly in a smaller business. What new regulations would be introduced and how will they be enforced? And we have the Dodd-Frank Financial Reform Act, which I think has a lot of problems to it, although I'm not going to discuss that act today. But there was a lot of uncertainty about other regulations. There was discussions of, well, we're going to have to change how we approach antitrust policies, international trade policy, et cetera. There was a lot of anti-business rhetoric and many discussions about capping executive pay to various degrees and regulating it in many different ways. The uncertainty about the long-term fiscal situation of the U.S. We've had an enormously rapid increase in government spending as a share of GDP. For this fiscal year, it is 25%. Its long-term trend up until 2006 or 2007 was around 21%, 2021. I mean, fluctuated a little bit. That's a rapid increase in a short period of time. That's clearly the main cause of the large deficits that we're running now. So the problem of the deficit and more fundamentally of the long-term government spending and the budget and interest rates, enormous uncertainty if you think of making long-term commitments in any way. So these, I think, are some of the problems. And the last problem I mentioned, the deficit, long-term financial, fiscal situation of the U.S., is, I think, a very important problem. I think it's affected the recovery, and it will continue to affect the growth rate and the debt growth of the U.S. unless we do something about it. You'll note, I'm sure all of you have noticed, that Standard & Poor's yesterday issued a warning about the fiscal situation of the U.S., a warning that they said could be a prelude to lowering the AAA rating of U.S. Treasuries. Now, I never thought I would live to see the day when U.S. Treasuries wouldn't have a AAA rating. And I'm not saying we're necessarily going to see that, but we might well see that if we don't make more important changes. So as I see the fiscal situation, I would break it down into relatively short run, the next 5 or 6 years, and the longer run after that. Now, I recently published a paper with George Shultz and John Taylor in the Wall Street Journal, an op-ed piece, I think the October 4th issue, where we set out our short-run suggestions, how to get the government spending back to its levels, let's say, of early 2008 in a 6 or 7 year period of time. I'm not going to go over those suggestions because they're short-run. I think we made some good suggestions and showed the problem facing us, and I'll be happy to address some of those issues. But here I'll just note that there was a very sizable increase in expenditure since early 2008. And therefore, if we went back to the level of early 2008, it would be hard to say that we're imposing great hardships on the population as a whole, since we were only there 3 years ago or so. All right. So it seems to me to get back to that level makes a lot of sense. Not even saying go further than that, and it's not something that will that leave people any worse off if we do it right than they were in 2008, at least in terms of what government is doing for them. So I think it's perfectly doable. If we don't do it, the problem of the deficit in the next few years will remain a serious problem. What about in the long run or longer run? Longer run, I think of I'll divide the problem into two categories because I think these two categories are responsible for the biggest potential problems that we face or challenges that we face. The first one is entitlements. And entitlements means Social Security, retirement income, and medical expenditure, especially Medicare and Medicaid. And the second is the growth rate of the U.S. economy. And I want to interweave those two because I think they're closely related in terms of their impact on the financial fiscal situation of the U.S. government and, indeed, on the welfare of the American people. The burden of government spending clearly depends partly on the size of national income. You can spend at and increase your spending at a certain rate, but if income is growing faster than it was before, then the implications for the deficit are much smaller. And compound interest is a remarkable discovery. It's alleged that Einstein once said, and I couldn't. I've tried to trace it. I haven't been able to find that he actually said it, but it's great anyway. He is alleged to have said that compound interest is the greatest invention of humans. The greatest invention, but it has remarkable powers, and I'll give you some examples of that later. Okay, so growth rates are important. Now, the Congressional Budget Office in last year or two continues to make various projections about the growth of Medicaid, Medicare, and Social Security. If we look at Medicaid and Medicare alone, their projections are that they will grow by 2030 from what is now 8% of GDP to 15% of GDP, doubling, almost doubling. Think of it from the following point of view. Government spending is now 25% of GDP. Supposing it continues to be 25% of GDP, then if Medicare and Medicaid is 15% of GDP, that's 60% of government spending. That's a huge fraction. This is federal government spending. This is a huge fraction. Okay. So that's a big challenge. Now, you add in Social Security retirement income, which is not projected to grow as quickly because it has not been growing as rapidly, then that problem becomes more like 70% of a big government. 25% federal government is a big government. So that's a challenge. Okay. So the challenge, therefore, is twofold: how to reduce the rate of growth of entitlements. I'm not saying to cut back. That's impossible. How to reduce its rate of growth, and how to increase the rate of growth of the economy. And they're related, because if you reduce the rate of growth of entitlements, you reduce the rate of growth of government spending, you reduce the rate of growth in taxation, because one way or another, you have to tax and get tax revenue to pay for government spending. It may not be this year, it may be next year. You may tax the people by inflation rather than through an income tax or a corporate tax or a Social Security tax. But one way or another, the government is not exempt from the basic constraint that we all live under as individuals or as business people, that your outlays have to be matched to your inflow. Okay. So the government is no exception to that. And therefore, by reducing the rate of growth of government spending, I think we will have an impact on the rate of growth of our income. So those are not independent sides of the challenge. I'm not going to relate them too carefully, but I want you to be aware of that. We can reduce the rate of growth of spending. That will be a force, I think, raising the rate of growth of income. So let me look at the entitlements. And I'll go through them I'll go through everything relatively quickly. I'm not going to speak for very long because I generally prefer Q&A to my lecturing. I've done enough lecturing in my life as a professor. But let me go through them briefly to warm you up, and I'll make some claims, and maybe some of you will differ with me on some of these claims. I think Social Security, in principle at least, is a relatively easy problem to tackle. My friend George Shultz says it's a piece of cake compared to health spending, and I think he's right about that. It's relatively easy, partly because it's not growing as fast and partly because it's a much less complicated type of problem. What can we do to slow down the rate of growth in Social Security? Well, there are a number of approaches that are quite feasible. Politically, they're all difficult. I mean, we don't get government spending and other government activities because of accidents. There's always somebody who's benefiting from what the government is doing or is benefiting from what the government isn't doing. So, I mean, that's just the way a democratic system operates. But conceptually, they're easy. And I think potentially easier probably also to implement politically. How would we approach Social Security? Well, there's a more extreme change that we go to an individual account system, like an IRA or a SEP account, where you put away resources to finance your old age. If I had my druthers, that's the system I would prefer. and I can go into that in detail. I've thought about that problem for a long time. But I'm going to take a less radical approach because the implementation of a individual account system, I think, will ultimately come here, as it has come to many countries of the world, actually. But I don't think it's in the near future that we'll see such a system. So what's a simpler way to do this that would also be very useful? I'll mention two components of what a simpler change is. One, raise the retirement age to age 70 for anybody who's physically and mentally capable of working to age 70. When the age 65 retirement age, and 62 now for a lot of people, came in, it was in the 30s when the U.S. introduced Social Security. People's life expectancy was much lower at age 65 than it is today, much lower, not just a little bit lower, but much lower. They were also in lower quality health when they were living. They're much more likely to have heart conditions and other disabilities. The increase in life expectancy in terms of number of years has gone along with increase in the quality of life of older people. And so most workers are well capable, and indeed many, if not most, would desire the opportunity to stay on longer. Unfortunately, the way Social Security is structured, you have an incentive to retire earlier rather than later. And we are slowly extending Social Security to age 67. But we should move much faster and much more boldly. I think 70 is the right age. And maybe some people say eventually be 75. Now, some of you say, well, that's not feasible. But take Japan. Now, Japan faces even more serious problems than we do because they have declining population, relatively few young people, low birth rates, and they live longer than Americans. The average Japanese male retires from the labor force at age 68. The average American male retires around 64. So if the Japanese can do it, why can't the U.S. do it? And their retirement age is growing rather than shrinking. So I think it's perfectly feasible. People are healthy enough to do it for the most part. There'll always be exceptions you want to provide for, of course. But it's perfectly feasible, and I think people will be happy if they didn't have this financial incentive to retire early, if you took away that incentive. And it would do enormous benefits for the ability to finance a retirement income, for the ability to finance Social Security. For the ability to finance Social Security. The second proposal is to mean test much more severely than we're doing now. There's no reason, in my judgment, why those of us who are reasonably well off or very well off should be collecting Social Security. I get a monthly payment from Social Security, and I wouldn't be one of the rich men of the world or the U.S., but it seems to me it's ridiculous that I'm getting this benefit. Now, we have a myth about Social Security, that we pay for Social Security because Social Security taxes, and then, well, we're getting back what we put in when we retire. That may hold to some extent for people of low incomes, but it does not hold at all for people of middle or higher incomes. They're paying in much more than they're getting back. And so think of Social Security taxes as just another tax that goes into the general federal budget and is used to spend on a variety of things. And out of some of that budget comes retirement income. There's no close connection. We have no fund that we build up or anything. So there's really no connection between Social Security and taxes. So once we think of it that way, then we think of Social Security as a transfer payment to help some people. That's fine. We want to have that type of minimal standard. And for the rest of the people, they shouldn't be getting any Social Security. They will save and so on. So this would be a way to save a lot of resources and I think be a much more sensible system. So that would be, those are my two proposals on Social Security. Extend the age and have a means-tested Social Security system. Let me say something about, I'm going to concentrate on Medicare because that's the most rapidly growing of all the medical expense, most rapidly growing entitlement in the United States. It, as I indicated earlier, it takes a big chunk of the budget. I'm not going to argue, because I don't believe it, that, you know, health spending is not valued by people overall. It's greatly valued by people. We have studies in economics where we estimate, it might seem like we're estimating the impossible, but we estimate what people are willing to pay for improvements in the, how long they can live, for small changes in how long they can live. Like, say, if the death rate from cancer went down by 10%, how much would individuals value that? And studies show they would value it enormously. People put a lot of value on the quantity and the quality of their life. And it's demonstrated time and time again from looking at how people respond to various risks, and in particular life risk. So in the best of worlds, health spending as a share of GDP would have gone up over time. I have no doubt about that. As people get wealthier, they want to spend more of it in improving their life, how long they live, reducing their death rates from cancer and cardiovascular disease, diabetes, and a variety of other things that attack us, particularly as people get older. So that would go up. And we have, in many respects, a very good health delivery system of the United States. That's also something I strongly believe. But it's far from a perfect system, and it can be improved significantly. If I take Medicare, I would say it has two major problems, a bunch of others, but two major problems as I see it. One, too little out-of-pocket expenses compared to expenses paid by others. You know, if somebody else is paying for you for buying anything, you like more of it than if you're paying it for it yourself. People are a lot more careful when they're spending their own money than when they're spending whoever else's money it is. I mean, that's a fact of human nature and long recognized. And we have a much lower out-of-pocket share than, say, a country like Switzerland, who provides good health care. We do, too, but they provide good health care in a more efficient way, partly because they put more of the burden on the part of people who want to take some additional forms of spending. And secondly, I think we don't have enough competition for the patient's dollars, or the older patient's dollars. So how can we improve that in the long run? Well, I think there will be two components of a way of improving it. And I like some of the aspects of Representative Ryan's roadmap that he recently came out with, and I blogged about that for those of you who are looking at the blog. A few weeks ago, shortly after it came out, I had a blog on evaluating the proposal. Two aspects that I like, they're related, is that instead of having directly government-funded expenditures on medical care, one would require people when they reach age 65 to buy health insurance. The health insurance companies would compete for each other nationally, so you wouldn't be confined to those in your state nationally. And secondly, the government would give for lower income people, would give a certain amount that they can use to cover the premiums on the health care coverage each year, and higher income people will get a fraction of that amount until you, at the very highest income, that fraction is very small. So you make higher income people pay more of their own money. You provide a basic level that the level would be set to give decent health care to low income people, and that would be indexed to increase in the cost of living. And everybody else gets maybe something, but much less, so they're paying more of their own money. And people can buy whatever, however expensive plans they want, but once they go beyond what they're getting, they have to pay for that out of their own pocket. It seems to me that builds in incentives for people to economize if they wanted very expensive plans. That's fine. Some people would put more money into that. And it also brings in the forces of competition to compete for patients' dollars in terms of premiums and the type of coverage that is offered. And people can buy very different types of coverage. They would have to pay, they have to use what they're getting as a subsidy, but they're entitled to use to add to that. I think that would have a sizable effect on the growth of Medicare and greatly reduce it. By attacking it in a more sensible way, where again we means test it and we bring in competition. Those two features I think are important. I like to say there are two principles of economics. People respond to incentives, good or bad, but they respond to them. And the competition makes for better outcomes and when you don't have competition. Those have been verified in economics. There's one thing economists are confident about, it's those two things. And they're very important. And you want to build those in as much as you can into all government programs. Okay. Now let me come to growth rates. I said before that the importance of compound interest. U.S. has grown long-term over the last 100 years on the average about 3% a year. 1% for population growth and 2% in per capita, per person growth. Okay. Now, if you're growing at 3% a year, GDP doubles in 24 years. If you're growing, if we could get that growth rate up to 3.5%, let's say population growth remains the same, we can increase the growth in per capita income to 2.5%. Not easy to do. Sounds easy, but it's not easy to do. If you can get that growth rate up to 3.5%, then over a 40-year period, you would increase the income per capita in the United States by a third. That's enormous, by a third. So if you look at the debt-GDP ratio, you would have a big effect, whatever the debt was, a big effect on the debt-GDP ratio. So there's a lot of incentive to try to get the growth rate up. Compound interest, Einstein was right. Compound interest is a great invention. And if you either you get killed by compound interest or you get benefit a lot by compound interest. So how can we get the growth rate up? Now, once I discuss these a little bit, I'll conclude. And we still have time for questions? Yeah. Okay. I have two proposals to get the growth rate up. Improve investments in human capital. And economists show convincingly that human capital is the main engine of economic growth in all modern societies. And broaden and flatten the income tax rates. So we have flatter taxes with a broader income base. All right, let me quickly discuss some of the human capital. One way to do it is through immigration. You attract a larger number of more skilled, ambitious immigrants who set up companies and are just generally more productive. In principle, it's easy to do. There are a lot of people of all skills who want to come to this country, and we stop them from coming. Now, I'm not saying we can have unlimited immigration, but we can certainly greatly increase the immigration. We're an empty country. Fly across the United States and fly across Europe, and you see the big differences. We're an empty country, basically. So there are no economic or other factors that we couldn't afford to take and couldn't benefit from taking, I would say, a much larger number of skilled immigrants. Now, I just came out with a little monograph. I forgot exactly the title of it, but the proposal is in the monograph is based around the discussion to sell the right to immigrate. Everybody could come if they pay a certain price that we would set, aside from terrorists and obvious people we don't want in this country. There would be no price, or maybe we could. No, there's always a price for everything, but let's say there's no price. There's no price for terrorists. Everybody could come, let's say 50,000, and we'd have an immigration loan program, like the student loan program, that would help people don't have that all that money available. They might have to pay 10,000 down and borrow the other 40. It would work smoothly. It would attract skilled immigrants, young immigrants. And I worked out the details in that proposal. I think the book is called The Challenge of Immigration. And I think it would enormously help. So that's one, in principle, easy. I'm saying politically it's easy. But I'm talking here as an economist as I view various opportunities for what we can do. Okay, principle easy. Number two, improve our educational system. There's been a worldwide boom in higher education in the last 30 years. And I document that in a professional paper that I published a few months ago. Worldwide, it's been rich countries, poorer countries, middle developing countries. The U.S. has partially participated in that boom, but has fallen behind. It's fallen behind. We have a great system of higher education, the greatest system, in my judgment, of any country in the world. But we do not have the largest number of people, largest fraction of students going on for higher education. We used to. We're now anywhere from 12th to 16th, depends on how you calculate it. Women have improved their education a lot. 57% of all the four-year degrees in the United States now go to women. In 1970, it was just the opposite. But men have lagged. The fraction of young men who go on for higher education is no different today than it was in 1975, fraction. Why? Well, there are a bunch of reasons, but partly a lot of men, and some women too, but a lot of men drop out of high school. If you don't finish high school, you can't go on for higher education. And 25% or so of young men are not graduating high school. So that lops off a sizable fraction. Korea, almost 100% are graduating high school. China is moving beyond the U.S., and China's income is maybe one-fifth per capita of the U.S. income. We're lagging. We used to be leading, first in high school in the early part of the 20th century, and then in universities, and now we're lagging in both dimensions. A very serious problem. There are various ways to improve it. I'm a strong believer in charter schools and vouchers. I also think we have to think more how to improve the stability and structure of families. So I have to come out in favor of a tax benefit for more stable families, because I think the weakened family structure of money children is responsible for the fact that children who come from weak families are much more likely not to finish high school. All right, so let me just then conclude. There's short and long-term problems for the U.S. They're related because part of the short-term problems are related to our long-term problems. The long-term problems are mainly twofold, likely very rapidly growing government expenditures on entitlements unless we do something about it, and a rate of growth of income that will be too small, rate of growth of GDP, relative to our likely increase in government spending. So what I try to do is suggest, one, how to cut down the growth in government spending, and how to increase the rate of growth of income. If we succeed in doing that, I believe the future economic prospects of the United States can be extremely bright. Thank you.
Thank you, Professor Becker. We have several questions. Let's begin with this one. Who has won between the Keynesians and the monetarists, or is it a scoreless tie?
Good question. Well, I would say who has won between the Keynesians and the non-Keynesians, because the non-Keynesians encompass monetary factors, but also many other aspects. I believe the Keynesians have lost. Now, let me say, ever since I came to the University of Chicago, I haven't been a Keynesian. I have a little bias in that direction. But let me give you a statistic that I think is the most telling. We were told by the incoming Council of Economic Advisers in 2008 that if we had a stimulus package of $800 billion or so, the unemployment rate would come down within a year and a half or so to under 8%. That would be an enormous decline. And I've read the paper. I thought it was a poorly done paper based on almost no real evidence. And the forecast has turned out to be completely wrong. We have spent almost all the $800 billion that we did vote on for a stimulus package, and it hasn't done the job. That was Keynesianism at its most naive. So I wouldn't like to say who has won and who has lost. It's a process of what how we understand macroeconomic phenomena continues. But I think what happened when the financial crisis came along, a large fraction of the population who may have been closet Keynesians became outright Keynesians. And I think the experience of the last couple of years has given pause to these people as well as other people.
Thank you. Related to your comments on education, given the complexity of our economy, isn't the risk much greater for an investment in higher ed? Misallocation carries huge costs. We already subsidize higher ed and see low returns.
I'm not quite sure, though. Can you? Let me look at it. Yeah, so the question is, haven't the returns to higher education been low for a variety of misallocation reasons and so on? No, I think it's just the opposite. If you look at the data, the benefits from going to higher education, the monetary benefits, a lot of others, health benefits, I can go into this. I can invite me back. I'll give you another lecture about that. The benefits are enormous from going to higher education, not just money. But let's just look at the money, how much higher your earnings are on average, or how much lower your unemployment rate is on average. They're enormous, and they've increased greatly since 1980. So I'll give you one statistic. In 1980, the typical college graduate earned about 40% more than typical high school graduate in the United States. Of course, a lot of variations around that within both groups, but it's typical. In 2010, the typical college graduate earns, instead of 40% more, 70% more. So enormous increase. And if you look at people with postgraduate education, that's grown even more rapidly. People say, well, unemployment, high college graduates suffer from unemployment. It's just not true. The unemployment rates have continued to be and have always been in the United States far higher for people who dropped out of high school and high school graduates. For example, a college graduate has less than half the unemployment rate than do high school graduates. So I would differ with the premise of that. I think college pays off a lot. The puzzle is, why aren't more young Americans going on for higher education?
Do you think we should get rid of the Federal Reserve?
No, I don't think we should get rid of the Federal Reserve. I do think we should institute rules-based behavior on the Federal Reserves, like an inflation targeting or some combination of inflation targeting and GDP growth targeting, and then everything else is done automatically. And in real emergencies, then you give the Federal Reserve more flexibility and more discretion. But overall, I think it's good to have a central bank who is looking at some very simple statistics and setting policy automatically to respond to those statistics to keep inflation within bounds and possibly also looking at the growth of a GDP. So if we made it a rules-based Federal Reserve rather than a discretionary-based Federal Reserve, we wouldn't have had the catastrophe of the Federal Reserve during the Great Depression and the mistakes made in 2004, 2006 by Greenspan in keeping interest rates too low.
I have several questions here concerning the discussions going on in Congress about reducing the deficit and links to the deficit ceiling. One question is it a good idea to connect the two? If we cannot reach agreement on spending cuts and the U.S. debt limit is not raised, what are the short and long-term market implications? And finally, do you have a favorite or least favorite of all the various budget plans that have been put forth so far?
Yeah. Well, there were interrelated questions on the current discussions on the budget. I partly addressed them, but let me come back to them again. The debt ceiling will be raised. It will be raised. And it's not the right way to, I think, to attack the deficit problem. And the government won't shut down, at least I hope not. I think that would be a mistake to shut down the government. On the other hand, I do think we need very serious reforms in spending. I mentioned in my presentation that government spending has risen enormously in the last few years. Enormously. Unprecedented during the last 30 years or so, the rate of increase. Now, some of it, I think, was justified in fighting the financial crisis. So I'm not saying the government should have just stayed around and not done anything to fight that crisis. But a lot of it, like the almost $1 trillion stimulus package, I think was mainly a waste of money, maybe even worse than that, misallocation of money. So we have to get spending down in the near-term future. We have to get it down in the longer term. Because the entitlement bomb that we're seeing is a real bomb unless we do something about it. Now, which of the plans are the best? They all have their problems, but I'll repeat what I said in my presentation. I think we have to attack Social Security and Medicare. The best ways to do that, I outlined a few, and I won't repeat them, but we have to make them both more means-tested, raise the retirement age, cut the subsidies on Medicare to those who have their own means, encourage them to buy insurance when they retire from the labor force, hopefully at age 70, but currently, let's say, at age 65 when Medicare kicks in. So those would be things that we have to do. Other components of the budget will have to share in any cut. So military spending maybe has gone up a lot mainly because of the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. Some adjustment will have to be made in that budget. I'm not an expert enough on defense spending to know how big that cut should be, so I'll leave that for others to discuss. Agricultural subsidies should go if we could go to them. Flatten the income tax, flatten all taxes. And I didn't really elaborate on this, but what I would like is a flat income tax where you tax, let's say, 25%. I think you can do it all with 25% flat tax, with an exemption for low-income people. They don't pay any taxes. And dividends are only taxed once when people get it as income, and undistributed corporate profits are taxed at the 25% rate. So you are taxing that as income to the implicit owners of that, so you do it through the corporations. You broaden the tax base, and this is where you're getting a lot of squealing in the you eliminate the interest rate deduction on mortgages. So any builders here won't be too happy with that proposal. And you eliminate a lot of other deductions. So you get a broader tax base and a much lower rate for most of the population. I think you can take in at least as much revenue as we're doing under the present system and greatly reduce the disincentive effects from the variety of taxes we have, the high corporate income tax that we have, and the high, for some people, high personal income tax rates, and yet collect just as much in a much more efficient way. I've had some colleagues who have said you can put all that on a postcard when you make all these simplifications. You don't have to fill out. I just filled out my income tax form as the rest of you did. I used an accountant and so on. The amount of resources going into the complexity of the code it makes sense only to tax lawyers and tax accountants. With the proposals I'm suggesting, you can put it on a postcard. You fill in a couple of things, and that's and then you fill out your taxes. So these are some of the reforms.
We're about out of time, but there is one person in the audience, at least, who would like to know your forecast of interest rates 1 year out, 3 years out, 5 years out.
Well, economists are bad at forecasting in general. and are bad at forecasting interest rates and exchange rates in particular. All right, but let me, I'll just give a very rough forecast. I'm not going to give a number. I'm not an interest rate forecaster. Interest rates are going to have to rise in this country. Either they're going to rise only in, mainly in nominal form because of inflation. I think that would be a bad outcome, but we have a great inflationary potential created by a lot of the Federal Reserve and Treasury activities over the last few years. So the banks are holding maybe $1.5 trillion of excess reserves. One way or another, eventually they're going to want to lend these reserves, and that will create a problem. Now, the Federal Reserve can overcome that by selling back treasuries. That will raise interest rates. I anticipate they're going to do some of that. So I anticipate interest rates will rise as inflation rises, as the Federal Reserve tries to combat the inflation. I think it'll rise within the three-year period, maybe substantially, and I think they'll be higher in 5 years than it is now. That's as far as I'm going on forecasting.
Thank you, Professor Becker, for your very interesting and thoughtful.
You've been listening to economist Gary Becker. In addition to winning the Nobel Prize, Becker received the National Medal of Science in 2000 and the Presidential Medal of Freedom in 2007. Coming up next time on the Economic Club of Indiana, Mark Emmert, the new president of the Indianapolis-based NCAA. Emmert jumped into his new job intent on modifying the controversial one-and-done rule to keep more student-athletes in college. Emmert is a former president of the University of Washington and succeeded Miles Brand at the NCAA. The Economic Club of Indiana is a production of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations. Thank you for joining us. I'm Sharon Alseth.
Proliance Energy, providing natural gas to more than 1,200 commercial, industrial, utility, and municipal customers. Proliance, adding power to energy. Information is at proliance.com.